Good evening. This is Mae Bressel. The title of this broadcast is World Watchers. It's program number 711, July the 22nd, 1985. I wanted to make just a few comments about Ronald Reagan's illness and then go on with the Simon Wiesenthal story because I believe that is the most important material that I can share with you this week, and then relate some of the current articles in the newspaper back to both the Reagan shooting and to the Simon Wiesenthal biography. You probably watched the news conference when Larry Speake said that the president's sanity was tested, in quotes, actually tested by the recitation of two poems, both of them having to do with death, the cremation of Sam McGee and the shooting of Dan McGrew. And the nurses actually had books in their hand. The Robert Service poetry book was brought to the hospital to Bethesda, and they followed it line for line, page for page, and he did it flawlessly, and therefore his mind is fine. Heaven help us if this is true. Of course, when he came home, he had the music of the Marine Band, The Saints Come Marching In, and that's a funeral song originating from New Orleans, played at the time of death. I don't think this was purposeful on the Marine Band's part, but certainly a idiotic thing, so that the poems and the music all happened to pertain to death. The Los Angeles Times had a detailed story called An Anatomy of a Cancer. It may have been syndicated in some of your papers, and it may not, but I want to run down a couple of dates with you because I had made the allegations in 1981 that he would be having cancer in 3.5 years, so I think that this report was interesting. March the 3rd, and that's another date that I'm going to bring up again in terms of Joseph Mengele's story. March the 30th is an important date. That's the day Ronald Reagan was shot, and Alexander Haig said, "I'm in charge." That was in 1981 when John Hinckley shot him. In 1982, as I mentioned last week, he went back to the hospital with urinary problems and some difficulty with his kidney, and he had various tests at that time just for the kidney. And this was the first indication that something was wrong with Ronald Reagan's body, at least the first that they were telling us. 1 year or 8 months after the shooting was a sign that part of that body was breaking down. And after that time, there were no more physical tests done for 2.5 years. We thought the president has an examination every year. It was 2.5 years, so that the next date was May 18th, 1984, the first complete physical in 2.5 years where the doctors discovered an inflammatory, what they called a pseudo polyp on the large intestine, and they determined it was benign, and they only removed some of it. They left some of it on and removed part of it and didn't order the colonoscopy, which you know was not given and should have been given, along with other tests. And Larry Speake said then the doctors will decide later if they need to do anything. And the hemocults were done to detect blood in the stool, a sign that cancer may be present in the intestine. That was done in 1984 when that polyp was taken off. And 2 months later in July, the president's doctor, Dr. Daniel Ruge, R-U-G-E, said that the doctors decided not to conduct any further examination of the president, that he will not have a physical for 2 to 3 years. This is in 1984. They jump every 2 years, so even though he had been shot and had these kidney problems. And he said the growth that took place in May is something you don't have to worry about. And later that assessment of Dr. Ruge became the center of controversy when they discovered that the president had developed cancer. He said, "You don't have to think about that at all. We only took out part, and we're not doing further tests." So March the 8th, he began to get tests. He had a physical examination. It was after the inauguration now, 2 months after. And then a second polyp was on the colon, and the doctor said it should be removed. Now, the White House, according to the Los Angeles Times, there's a lot of controversy of who said what at what time. The White House said put it off until later in June, and they waited until after the Bitburg Cemetery visit. I think that the going to Germany, putting the wreath at the grave sites where the Waffen-SS are buried, helping Helmut Kohl try to get reelected in Germany, was a commitment the president made in November of 84. And I think symbolically, this was important because, as I mentioned last week, this professor in Maryland was working on the skull of Mengele early in the year, about the same time period, February and March, and they were going to bury Joseph Mengele, and they were going to resurrect the kindly feelings towards the SS, and he had that commitment, and nothing was going to stand in the way of that, as you noticed. Nothing could stand in the way of that. So those tests and everything that were given to him in March of 84 are another large part of this controversy. The first being why they decided to wait a couple of years, 2.5 years, after the one test of the polyp. And the second, why they would have to wait after March to take care of him. That was another part of the controversy. Then the LA Times said, at this point, some specialists suggest that even if the results were not conclusive, they should have followed more aggressively as of March 84, 85, because the tests indicated at that time there was blood in the stool. So he waited then, and then through June, he said he had the hostage crisis, which had nothing at all to do with whether Ronald Reagan would have surgery or not. The hostage crisis could have come and gone, and he could have done from his hotel room, from his hospital bed, not his hotel room, his hospital bed, or the White House, exactly what he's doing now. He didn't do anything about the hostage crisis except a few words back and forth, and everyone else handled the matter. So that was put off till June, and then July the 12th, when he had an examination, a new polyp was discovered, and then they had to go into the colon and remove 2 feet of the colon. The surgeons at Bethesda by July the 13th. Now, July 15th, Dr. Rothenberg said the polyp is malignant, and it has spread into layers of the walls of the colon, but he indicated there were no cancer cells at the time. Another report in the newspaper said that when they opened him up, they thought that they would immediately start the chemotherapy, but the advantages didn't disadvantage of having the chemotherapy, the inconvenience to the president, weren't equal. He shouldn't go through that as of the advantages of having it. So that leaves open the question, what did they really see? Now, Dr. Edward Catau, C-A-T-T-A-U, at Bethesda, said the first polyp was not the type you would remove, and it may not indicate subsequent growth, but he found that his name was brought up in controversy later because other doctors says the proper procedure, of course, would be to give a barium enema and see if other polyps were present. They took off one, and they only took off half of it, but they didn't follow it up. The standard procedure is the colonoscopy and the barium enema within 6 months, and they started by saying, after the last exam, we'll wait another 2.5 years. Now, Catau said a lot of thought went into give the test, but it was Reagan's doctors, not him, not Dr. Catau at Bethesda, but Reagan's doctors that decided against it on the grounds that the cellular characteristic of the first polyp didn't indicate cancer. So he put it back into the hands of the other doctors. Now, Dr. Rosenberg endorsed this Dr. Catau at Bethesda's plan in May of 84 based on the fact that he didn't seem to appear a cancer risk and that annual examinations would take care of that. But in March 85, when the hemocult test indicated that there was blood in the stool, the doctors recommended the colonoscopy, and then the tests were delayed. And that's where the doctors waited 2 years, 2.5 years, and said, well, we better do it now. Here's blood. Then the other doctors, away from Bethesda, delayed it because they said it was the president's schedule. Many of you know people who've had cancer or members of your family, and usually from the time you get the diagnosis, you make arrangements and get into the hospital as fast as you can. Larry Speaks says, it is correct to say there was no recommendation for further testing in 1984. Nothing at all. And another criticism is the urgency with which the medical team recommended it. The Bethesda naval doctors detected the presence of a second polyp, but they made no recommendation of urgency. But another person got into the act, a Captain Carney, the internist who coordinated the physical exam. And he said Dr. Cateau strongly urged in March of 84 a colonoscopy be done as soon as possible. So going back and forth, what did Bethesda say? What did Reagan's advisors say? I think Ronald Reagan wanted to win the election and didn't care. And he was committed to Helmut Kohl, and he put that off. And the urgency never, if it had dawned on him, it probably wasn't pressed, because one doctor, Cateau, strongly urged it in March of 84 as soon as possible. And Bethesda has been criticized for putting it off. But Captain Carney said they were criticized unfairly when the test wasn't done in 1984. But that it's the White House doctors who have the final authority for what is done, and he should set the record straight. Why they didn't agree on a colonoscopy was not needed then. He doesn't understand it. So the urgency issue in March 85 should have been pressed, and he should have taken care of it right then. The problem of more tests in 84 should have been called to attention. And hemocult tests certainly in March 85 demanded immediate attention, not into July. And some people believe he only decided to do it because his brother had cancer. Another issue that was brought up is the hemocult test given in 84 seemed to be negative with blood in the stool, but by March 85, the two tests were positive. Now, the White House doctors say they gave two tests that were positive and two were negative, but the authorities say that that doesn't mean anything because often you can have both. You can have polyps that bleed and then they stop bleeding. So if you have any sign of the bleeding, you do the barium enema and the colonoscopy. You do both of them at that point, and that triggers further investigation on why they would say, I did it now and it shows it, and I do it a week later and it doesn't. It's characteristic that it may not show up. And so these issues and the squabbling was done, recorded in the Los Angeles Times this past week. And I think the whole story, of course, is gross, and it's pretty obvious to everyone around the country, or most people who think about it, not obvious to those who don't think about it, that a lot of questions that should be answered never will, but they're being posed at least. Some people resent the news media bringing them out in the open. They want to accept the fact that he has this cancer, he was cured, he's fine, you have no right to discuss it, and it shakes too many people to think of the possibilities. Now, I want to mention just one news story about Aja, Mehmet Ali Aja, who hasn't been on the stand testifying this past week, but some very important information came out in the New York Times, just opening up this trial again, regarding the contacts of Aja with various people dealing drugs and selling weapons that are linked in some way or tied to the assassination plot on the Pope. And again, these dates are very important. This story, one that I have that I want to refer to in detail probably next week, is called Turk in Rome Case Details Smuggling. And this is Bekir Selenk, C-E-L-E-N-K, who allegedly had given money to Aja to shoot the Pope. He said he didn't. But he is telling in the courts, this is July the 17th, New York Times story, he's telling the court about the drug traffic and the weapons from Czechoslovakia and West Germany and the Middle East and the heroin and going to Turkey and Lebanon and into the Swiss banks and into money and funds of Syrian dealers, because Mr. Arsan, A-R-S-A-N, tied to STIPAM, S-T-I-P-A-M. That is the Banco Ambrosiano P2 Masonic Lodge fascist Nazi apparatus that was exposed just the same week that the Pope was shot in May of 1981. That story broke open. Aja is linked to STIPAM, S-T-I-P-A-M, and the drug center in Milan. And the important thing is that at the time that the Pope was selected to be killed, the people working out of the Swiss banks and in Syria could very easily and are linked to, down to Licio Gelli, to Klaus Barbie and Joseph Mengele and Stefano Della Calle and Mr. Tuma from Syria, the chief of police from Sao Paulo, Brazil. I'm convinced that he is part of the STIPAM operation. So the drug and arms dealer, Mr. Selenk, is talking in the courts of Italy in Rome, and all of a sudden, for most purposes, there's been a blackout this past week, at least maybe in the European press, but in the papers that I read this past week. But the whole circle of events from the assassination attempt of Ronald Reagan in March and the assassination attempt to the Pope in 1981, the two of them in May 81, may have an awful lot to do with their knowledge and participation with people involved in international drug traffic, such as Licio Gelli being at Reagan's inauguration and working with Michael Ledeen and Alexander Haig. The web of the shooting of the two men to the narcotics traffic and to the top Nazis in South America that were later brought in after Reagan and the Pope were shot, plus Barbie was brought to France. Mengele has been officially buried. There's a whole network that I will draw and diagram for you because it's hard to comprehend it as each individual article comes along. Now, in 1979 was the investigation that the judge started to make into the P2 in Italy, into this international connection of Stipam that turned out to be the links to Hollywood, to Colonia Dignidad, to Ronald Reagan, the Republicans, the international drug traffic, Carlo Palermo, the judge in Italy, Trento, Italy. March 1982 began series of arrests that broke the story of the links of Banco Ambrosiano, Roberta Calvi, Licio Gelli, and it also goes into Israel. These stories of Stipam and the arrests in Italy go to Israel and their role with receiving oil with the Dutch government, Royal Dutch Shell, Prince Bernhard as the intermediary when they needed oil during the hostage crisis. The last time Israel would send guns and weapons to Khomeini, who was in power. And the network of people associated with each other, such as Royal Dutch Shell and Simon Wiesenthal, Israel and drug traffic, Israel and the need for oil, explains a lot of reasons why so many people are silent and willing to put Mengele to rest. The Israeli government this week said they still believe he's alive, but there are a lot of people like Simon Wiesenthal and hundreds of others that are willing to bury him. Now, the investigations into Stipam, which have their connections to Syria, and Romeo Tuma, as I say, the police chief and head of the death squad and the terror gang down in Brazil, his family are from Syria. He's a Syrian, a devout Catholic. Those investigations began in 1979. In 1979 is when the CIA had memos that Joseph Mengele was heavily involved in cocaine traffic and that Hans Settlemyer was the money man with the Mengele factories in South America. It was in February of 79 when Joseph Mengele would officially be buried, so if they needed to resurrect him later, Mr. Tumo and the police and the Americans and the Bonn German government could say that Mengele was buried. It was in 1979 that Agen, a far-right member of the Grey Wolves fascist organization drug dealer, killed the editor in Turkey, Abdi Ireki, I-R-R-I-R-E-K-C-I, Ireki, I don't know if I pronounce it right. Agen murdered him in 1979 and then was sprung out of the jail. In 1979, the Shah of Iran was still in power, and Iran was running a heavy dope operation, of course, in the Shah's family and the French connection that our banks depended upon, and money from dope and oil, of course, could go into banks like Chase Manhattan, the Boston Bank, the Continental Illinois, and so forth. In 1979, Khomeini was in Paris, and the Shah was in Iran with the dope. The Soviet Union had not absorbed Afghanistan, which was an important part of the Western German-American drug money coming in. And India didn't have their separatist insurgency where the Sikhs would go into heroin growing and work with the Central Intelligence Agency. And after that interruption, after 79, when the arrests and investigations began to break down in Stipam, all of a sudden Khomeini's in power in Iran and that dope money's cut off from our government, our CIA, and the bankers. The Afghanistan drug market is cut off, and the CIA heroin and the separatist movement was built up to help with this triangle, the Golden Triangle, to keep the narcotics traffic going, as the Western world and the bankers and Swiss bankers lost the money from Iran and Afghanistan. They were pushing the heroin into India, into the Sikh movement, in return for promising the separatism. So 1979 is an important year, and it does link to operations not only in Syria, but I'll be doing more with you on Stipam International and how they worked with Israel. And British Petroleum and Royal Dutch Shell were sending money, oil, to Israel so they could function. They need oil. In return, Israel was giving Khomeini weapons. But Simon Wiesenthal is a close attachment, of course, to Israel, and a common denominator between him and the funding of Israel through this whole operation, the banks and oil, is, again, Royal Dutch Shell and Prince Bernhard, one who founded and helped the Wiesenthal Center going until 1979, till it built its own momentum. And it plays a part in supplying the oil for Israel so that the Shah, when the Shah was out, Khomeini could get the guns to fight Iraq. Now, I'm going, one other thing before I go into Simon Wiesenthal's story is, I mentioned last week the arrest of Mr. Roeder, Manfred Roeder, in Germany, the terrorist, again, who links to all of these international drug traffic patterns of the fascists, the Nazis, and the international network of guns and weapons, a right-wing passage, bringing in narcotics to pay for the guns and shipping guns to these various countries. Now, Manfred Roeder had a diary that was retrieved in Germany after he was arrested that gave the names of the interconnecting web of network of guns and drug traffic. He was arrested in September 1980, but in March the 30th, Manfred Roeder is the fellow whose diary with the connecting links was located, of Mr. Zundel up in Canada, who gave him the Nazi literature, the links of Zundel to the Institute of Historical Review, and Willie Cardo and that Nazi network. Now, the day that this story broke about the connections of Roeder from Canada to Los Angeles and around the world, literally around the world, with the guns and arming the Nazis and producing the Nazi literature. And this, of course, goes down to South America. And in 1985, it was Manfred Roeder who got a letter in his cell beginning to break the story about Joseph Mengele being dead. Well, March the 30th was the day that his diary of these connections that would go back or around Stipam and Banco Ambrosiano and Licio Gelli. Those people connect in their web that I call the Odessa Network. But the day that they printed the information about Roeder's diary and his connecting links was the day that Ronald Reagan was shot, and Alexander Haig, who had worked closely with Licio Gelli, as I say, and Michael Ledeen, and the entire network from Italy to Argentina, the Nazis throughout the world, when Haig said he was in charge, was the day Reagan was shot, was just simultaneous with the day that the diary of the connecting links of Roeder, Manfred Roeder, and again, that goes up to his close association with Richard Butler and the Aryan Nations, and Butler's working with Lockheed at the time of the U-2 flights and working with Thane Caesar, who was the actual person who murdered Robert Kennedy. And Ronald Reagan was on the Rockefeller Committee, allegedly, and of course not looking into the murder of John Kennedy. All of these interconnecting personalities that bump each other have days that overlap. So 1979 was a very important year. And of course, Roeder reaches all of these because the day that his network is revealed is the same day that Ronald Reagan is shot. And as I say, in 1985, he conveniently gets a letter in his cell just about March telling him uncle is dead, he drowned, and that's the excuse to go down to the beach in San Paulo, one of the excuses so that they could officially bury Joseph Mengele. They had from 1979 to 1985. If there was never anyone on his trail, it wouldn't matter. They'd leave him there. but within those 6 years, the body could rot sufficiently to have trouble recognizing it if they waited that long. So Roeder's name comes up linking to this international web of Nazis and to Permandex operation through the Klan and Nazi connections to John Connolly and to Richard Butler. So the day that, his network is revealed, and I'll do more on that later on Manfred Roeder, is the day that Ronald Reagan is shot in Washington, D.C., and I don't think it's coincidental that Haig is up there. He wanted to be in charge of the White House when Richard Nixon was taken away and Watergated. It was Alexander Haig who brought in Alex Butterfield. From the military intelligence that he worked with, they worked together earlier, to begin taping Richard Nixon in the White House, and it was those tapes that got him out of office. Haig is linked to coups, a planned coup by Licio Gelli in Italy to overthrow that democracy. He has relationships to people from the Bay of Pigs and those agents involved in murdering Kennedy. He had a big part in getting Richard Nixon out of office, and of course he grabbed the rostrum to take over when Ronald Reagan was shot. And Nixon and Reagan and this whole group are linked to the drug traffic, to the Nazis who escaped, to the international bankers who profit from the drugs, and to the Nazi network that was protected after the war and then got together as soon as possible when people began to relax and get themselves into the activities of what we know as the Cold War. Now, I'm going to rush through some years. I've done a lot on this matter. I'm going back to the chronology of these people later. I want to get right to Simon Wiesenthal and do as much as I can on the favors that were done for him, probably this week and next week, put a lot of the news aside, and just describe Simon Wiesenthal and ask some questions when I get through these chronology, the dates of his activities during the war and, of course, after the war. Now, one of the most valuable books that I have, along with other researchers, is that one by Mr. Reese, Kurt Reese, called The Nazis Go Underground. It was published in 1944, and I absolutely believe, based upon the things I read, and I'm taking most of this from Simon Wiesenthal's book and an interview in the Washington Post so that I don't slant it with opinions outside about Wiesenthal. I'm taking it from his own book written by a member of the OSS who was in the OSS when Wiesenthal was, and also his own interviews in Saga magazine and in the Washington Post, and asking you about him. I'm convinced that Wiesenthal's role, and it's outrageous to say this, but you think about it now, and we'll get back to it later, that his role as early as 1944, maybe the end of 43, seems indicated in 43, he already was going to have the role as the, in quotes, Nazi hunter, and the top Nazis and a lot of the Waffen-SS that he worked with through the war, through the last 2 years, or through the entire war, they seemed to be aware that he would be the historian or the record keeper of the crimes that certain guards did and the tortures, and they knew to be on his side. Now, that's an interesting concept because he studied as an architect for 3 or 4 years, and then he was painting signs, swastikas, and we love you, Adolf Hitler on the trains, taking people to the concentration camps and in celebration of Hitler's birthday and so forth. He was an artist. He wasn't a lawyer. He wasn't an investigator. But the Nazis, on several occasions, they seem to indicate that he will be in charge of who gets punished and who doesn't. And maybe this explains why he never looked for Otto von Bolschwing or the Iron Guard that came to this country, Mr. Trifia, or Nikolai Maloxa, or Werner von Braun, or the crimes of Mr. Dornberger and the NASA scientists, or Reinhard Gehlen coming here. The hunks of people that he ignored are just tremendous, or looking for Martin Bormann or Joseph Mengele, passing over the whole Odessa network of Karl Wolff and Hans-Ulrich Rudel and the mobility they had in and out of Germany while he was living there, or in Vienna where he lives. This reading the chronology of him during the war gives a pretty good idea of Simon Wiesenthal, not only in 1985, 2 days after the Mengele bones, if it's Mengele, that skull is dug up, that he's more convinced the second day than the first, with less reason, and none at all, as a matter of fact. And it also explains how deep and insidious the role was to rebuild the Nazis, to pass them over, let certain people take the rap. That's what happened. They selected certain guards or certain inmates and members of the Waffen-SS who were his friends. He was with them through this entire war period. Seemed to know where his wife was, how to find her. Saw his mother go into the ovens, but he survived. He's a survivor. I'm going to begin now on the second half on the chronology of Simon Wiesenthal, and next week do at least another half hour to complete it. But I want to go into Wiesenthal. How deep does his commitment go to those Germans to protect them in return for bringing a few of the little fish in? We'll begin that now and start with Simon Wiesenthal as a possible collaborator. That question was asked in a long article by Lyndon LaRoche, who discovered Fritz Kramer for me and for nobody else. He does ask questions. He had a long story on Simon Wiesenthal, accused him of being a collaborator. I think I can say the same thing, not paraphrasing Lyndon LaRoche, and I'm not a LaRoche or a Mooney or anything else. It seems that he obviously was. We'll begin that right now on the second part of this broadcast.